Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the Curzon Film Podcast. This week, sex, drugs, violence, corruption, dead sheep and lengthy sessions of sandwich eating are on our minds as we take a look at Paolo Sorrentino's Berlusconi biopic Loro, as well as hearing from modern Italian history writer and professor John Foote, and S. Craig Zahla drags us into the murky criminal underworld in Dragged Across Concrete. I'm Sam Howlett, and joining me in the studio this week, because they're too damn dangerous to be out on the streets, Kelly Powell.
Hello.
Stephen Ryder.
Hello.
And making his pod debut, Lou Thomas. Welcome.
Good morning.
So, Lou, you work a full-time day job for the BFI, but in your spare time, after dark, you're a freelance film critic for publications such as Little White Lies, The Skinny, Den of Geek. Missed any out?
Sight and Sound.
Sight and Sound. Brilliant. Nice. Welcome.
Oh, nice one. Cheers. Good to be here.
So before we hit the concrete, we turn our attention to Loro. Master filmmaker Paolo Sorrentino, he of Youth and the Great Beauty, teams up once again with longtime collaborator Tony Servillo to reveal the scandalous and until now unseen private life of Italy's most infamous politician, Silvio Berlusconi. Packed with sensational, satirical stings, biopics don't come more unauthorized than this. Before we get into the film, we're going to hear now from the professor of modern Italian history, John Foote, who has written numerous books on Italian history and culture and several articles about Berlusconi, which you can check out on sites such as The Guardian. We spoke about the legacy of Berlusconi, what he meant for Italy, and how that's translated to film in Loro.
Okay, and we're delighted to welcome to the Curzon podcast John Foote, professor of modern Italian history at the University of Bristol. Thank you for being here.
Delighted to be here. Thank you.
So you're obviously here to talk about Berlusconi and Loro. Can you tell us a bit about your history about writing about Berlusconi?
So I went to Italy in the late 1980s to do my PhD. And at that time, Berlusconi was just a businessman and president of Milan football team, but still a very big public personality. And I sort of lived through his incredible rise to power in the 1990s, and then I, at the same time, kind of was commentating on him for media, but also thinking about where he came from and why he was, what kind of figure he was. So I was both living in Milan, which is the center of Milan, of Berlusconi's power, and also kind of writing about it at the same time. So it's an interesting kind of combination of things. So Silvio Berlusconi is first and foremost a businessman. He made a lot of money from housing, and that's dealt with a bit in the film. And then he's kind of quite a brilliant businessman. He made money from housing, and then he went into TV. He was the first really big TV entrepreneur in Italy, private TV, which hadn't really existed. And he brilliantly picked up on the kind of consumerist boom in Italy. And so he becomes a big TV entrepreneur, advertising, publishing, and also sport. Football is crucial to his power. So he's a big businessman, very rich, very powerful, not in politics. And in 1994, when everything collapses in Italy under a huge corruption scandal, he decides to go into politics and incredibly wins an election 2 weeks after going into politics. I mean, right. It's one of the great, extraordinary political stories in contemporary world, and it really sets the scene for people like Trump, Farage, and a whole lot of other people. He writes the playbook for Trump. I mean, Trump actually copies quite a lot of things that Berlusconi does, from the sort of, you know, I can say one thing one day and one thing the next. Berlusconi did that all the time. The personalization of politics, the sexualization of politics, the fact you don't need a party. He didn't really have a party, just had himself. And a businessman going into politics, you know, I'm not a politician, I'm a businessman, I'm rags to riches. Yeah. This is Berlusconi, you know. And it's true in some cases, although there are lots of dark sides.
Sure.
And from 94 till right until 2008, he's in power for quite a lot of that time. Prime minister, head of a big company, owner of three TV stations, owner of a football team. I mean, he's an incredibly powerful political figure and economic figure in a major industrial country.
Okay. And what's the kind of thought about Berlusconi now, like particularly in Italy? How is he kind of remembered? What's the kind of the legacy of the Berlusconi era?
I think that's a really difficult question, because in some ways it's still going on. I mean, he's still in politics.
Yeah.
He stood, despite him being whatever he is, 83. He stood in the last election, didn't do that well, but still kind of went through the motions. So it's not, the era is over.
Mm.
I mean, he really presided over 20 years of Italian politics, like a sort of king or a monarch.
Mm.
That's over, but he's still around. How's he remembered? I think in some ways with quite a lot of affection. I think one of the things the film does very well, which is interesting, which is not usually done, is it shows how he has actually quite funny,
yeah,
and probably quite fun to spend an evening with in some ways. It's a bit of a difficult thing to say, but I think that is an interesting take. He's not antipatico, he's simpatico.
Mm.
And I think people kind of, even on the left, kind of touch into that.
Okay.
The hatred of the 90s and 2000s, I think, is fading. And he's a kind of slightly sad old man now who's still going through the motions and still has the young girlfriend and still has... I don't think he can really have the parties anymore, but we don't know that about that.
Okay.
So. But I think the important thing is he needs to be taken very seriously.
Right.
I think in Britain is often, when people used to ring me up, they always used to say, he said something stupid again. He said he's not having sex for a month. And I said, well, I think we really need to take this figure very seriously because he's doing something new with politics.
Well, this is kind of the argument about Trump as well, isn't it? Like, people sort of write him off as a cartoonish joke character, but then they don't really think about the impact of what he's saying and what he's doing.
Yeah, and Berlusconi, like Trump, had an enormous base. Mm. I mean, he won election after election. He reigned for longer than any other prime minister post-war Italy.
Mm.
Broke all records. So he's an extraordinary political laboratory. He kind of experimented with politics. Mm. And he changed everything, because now everybody wants to be a Berlusconi. Okay, even if they're on the left, they can't go back to the old ways of doing politics anymore. Mm. I think the one other film I would mention is The Caiman by Moretti,
mm-hmm.
where he is portrayed and it is about Berlusconi.
Right.
So that's an interesting, a much more sort of political take, I'd say. Sorrentino's profile is very mixed, I think. I think he's trying to do lots of different things with Berlusconi. He's trying to get up close to him. And kind of get deep into his marriage with Veronica Lario, which is breaking up in the film, really. It's kind of falling apart. So he's kind of trying to get us really kind of right up, you know, inside Berlusconi, beyond the myth, into his kind of walking around in his house, his dressing gown, his kind of... And I think that's an interesting thing to do, to try and get really, you know, right up to Berlusconi. So he's trying to do that. But he's also trying to do some kind of political stuff as well.
Mm.
And I'm not sure that those two things necessarily go together. Servillo, as ever, is amazing.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the voice is uncanny. It's incredible. It's more Berlusconi than Berlusconi. And that Milanese accent and that way of talking. And so Servillo is worth seeing the film just for Servillo for me. And he's always good. He's an incredible actor, probably a bit underrated outside of Italy. But I think the other thing he's trying to do is kind of try and understand this loneliness of this man who is so powerful. So many people throw themselves at him, and yet he's kind of, in the end, on his own.
Mm.
And I think that's interesting as well.
So this is for me anyway, this seems like quite an unusual biopic in that we don't see the subject of the biopic for a good 45 minutes, maybe even an hour, because before that we have these different characters who are talking about Berlusconi and are trying to get to him through all these different means possible. Can you talk about those characters? Because most of them are fictional but based on real people. Can you talk a bit about this kind of, you know, this network of people that are trying to get to him?
I think one of the things about Berlusconi, and some historians have talked about that, is he had a kind of court. Mm. He was like a medieval king.
Right.
And people, you know, he presided over this court, and people were always trying to get into his court because he could hand out favours. There weren't just political favours, there were also favours about being on TV, a part in a terrible play or on a TV show. He had all this power, which was economic and political. Incredible amount of power. So the film, I think, does something very interesting, which is tries to get to Berlusconi through this kind of entourage, yeah, who haven't quite got there yet, through a kind of pimp figure who thinks he'll get to Berlusconi by providing him with lots of beautiful young girls, yeah, which is kind of correct in this case. And I think that's a very interesting idea. I'm not sure it entirely works in the film, but it is an interesting idea. The person it's based on, I think, is called a guy called Tarantini, who was... and we don't want to get sued here, was involved in Berlusconi's entourage.
Right.
So it kind of tries to get to Berlusconi from the people who are around him. And I think that's a good tactic to try. And then it kind of presents you with Berlusconi in a very weird way, which I won't give away, as a, you know, in his Sardinian villa, yeah, having lost the election and thinking, how am I going to get back to power? We're in 2006, it's quite, yeah, clearly... And he's lost the election by 25,000 votes, nothing. Mm. And he's thinking, what am I going to do to get back into power?
Yeah, and I think what's so interesting about the film is that it really doesn't go into the politics that much. This is very much a human story, which for a figure almost fully known for their political life is really interesting, really strange.
It's intimate, and I think the scenes with Veronica are interesting because there's a certain tenderness to that,
yeah,
relationship. They're tired of each other. You know, they've been together a long time. She's tired of his affairs. But she's actually, I think that's an extraordinary performance as well.
I think it is, yeah.
Elena Sofia Ricci has won a few awards in Italy for that. I think it's a very powerful performance of this, you know, this very difficult figure of Berlusconi's wife, who's meant to basically say nothing.
Yeah.
And is meant to just accompany him to things that he doesn't really want to there anyway. But he has to have a wife because, yeah, he's Italian. He's an Italian politician, even if he's got thousands of girlfriends, which he exhibits around the place. I think that's the moment when she speaks out. And it, yeah, actually uses directly, she started writing letters to the papers who hated Berlusconi, interestingly. And the speeches she makes in the film are directly quoted from... I recognise the words.
Oh, okay.
And that's quite powerful, but I think it's quite intimately done, and I think that could have been developed further. This kind of marriage, which no one really knows about from the outside, and he's kind of tried to get deep into that, while everything else is going on with, you know, the parties and, yeah, and the drugs and all that kind of stuff.
Well, for such a long film, there are a few key sequences that really stick out to me, and this sort of argument between them is one of them. And there's a line in it where he says, "Men are limited beings, slaves to infantile temptations. They do not see the future they later regret." I think that's kind of sums up the thesis of the film in a way, and I think is really telling to kind of Berlusconi's legacy as well.
Yes, I think he thought he was untouchable. Mm. You know, I mean, he had so many court cases and got cleared. Time and time again, I mean, he's broken all records for court cases, but he's only been convicted once for tax evasion, not for any of the other things. Although, obviously, with Berlusconi, it's still ongoing.
Yeah,
I mean, you know, writing a book with Berlusconi is a nightmare because nobody understands the court cases. I mean, it's just already the Italian legal system is ridiculous, but there are still certain cases ongoing. Yeah. In this sequence, yes. And I think there's another key moment in the film where we see, I think, Sorrentino successfully, as he did in Il Divo, kind of gets under the skin of somebody that no one really knows, which was when Berlusconi goes back to being the salesman of the past and kind of rings up this random woman and tries to sell her house. And I think that is absolutely brilliant, that scene. And it really, that's the moment I think we try and we understand that Berlusconi is really a salesman, and he always was. And he was selling houses, but then he was selling himself. And him selling himself was incredibly successful.
Well, I've got one more question then. So the tagline for the film is "Biopics don't come more unauthorized than this." What do you think Berlusconi would make of the film? What would he? How would he react to this version of himself?
I think he would quite like this version of himself. It's not unfair to him. It's not a cartoonish portrayal. It kind of captures some of that comedian aspect that he actually would quite like. He would probably quite like to be a comedian or a singer, you know. And I think that whole thing about the entertainer, you know, I mean, even if people who hated him, and I was there in the 90s and I was surrounded by people who hated him, and I quite hated him to be honest, were just incredibly attracted to he was the center of attention, and he was brilliant at that. And that's, again, Trump does that as well, right? What's Trump tweeted today? What's Berlusconi said today? It's genius, right? It doesn't matter what it is.
Yeah.
And I think that he would quite like that. I think it does get under his skin. It, you know, it's not perfect. There's lots of issues with it. But I think it if you're interested in a portrayal of this kind of new kind of politician and a particularly interesting one, I think it would be an interesting film to see, for sure.
Brilliant. John Foote, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, then. So this is Sorrentino's first film since Youth, which was quite a weirdly big hit. And, you know, his past works include The Great Beauty, which won the Oscar for Best Foreign Language Film. This Must Be the Place, that really strange film where Sean Penn plays an aging rocker.
I've forgotten all about that movie.
The Consequences of Love, Il Divo. A lot of these are available on Curzon Home Cinema as well. We have a Best of Paolo Sorrentino collection, which you can check out right now to remind yourself of the man's great career. So, Loro then, guys. Initial thoughts of Loro. So this film was obviously in Italy. It was two parts, so it's two separate films. And with the director's approval, it's been stitched together, shortened down to one epic look at Silvio Berlusconi.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Initial thoughts.
Well, I guess I have no idea how the two films were split practically. But, I mean, there's definitely a kind of switch in the middle of the movie. The first part of the movie is about this young man who kind of moves from, I think it's, remind me of where he is?
South Italy.
Sardinia.
Yeah. So it's a young man who moves from southern Italy to Rome in search of, like, political kind of greatness, or at least social greatness, and uses women, prostitutes or kind of escorts to work his way up the ladder culturally and politically. And it's kind of fascinating that they refer to Berlusconi throughout the film as him, which is, you know, and the film Loro itself translates to them. So the first half of this film is definitely about the people who are, like, caught in this whirlpool of kind of corruption and nonsense that Berlusconi's kind of political, as a political figurehead, has created in this country. And it's about a young man trying to get to him, basically, so he can kind of improve his cultural currency, which is a really fascinating way to start the film.
Yeah, it kind of sets him up for this. He's this kind of character that is mysterious. You know, you kind of, people are trying to get to him. People are trying to, you know, enter his world, and so do we as a viewer want you know.
And it also looks beautiful. I mean, I was gonna give a shout out to Luca Bigazzi, who's worked on quite a few of Sorrentino's films, because Sorrentino is someone who's known for kind of like his very technically polished films. They're extremely stylish, extremely visually, I don't want to say inventive, but visually polished. Like you can't really take your eyes off them in a way.
Which is interesting, really, because when you look at what the actual content of the film is, it's more like Sorrentino's jump from like the great beauty to the great ugly, really, isn't it? Because that's what it's all about. It's about this dirty, corrupt individual that, you know, Berlusconi, you almost say it as a laugh. It's like a byword for corruption.
Yeah, exactly. And let's talk about that style then. So how does the style feed into the great ugly of this film? Because I think, you know, films to compare this to, for me anyway, were Vice, Death of Stalin, The Wolf of Wall Street, these kind of films that are overindulgent to represent overindulgence.
Yeah, I mean, it's you don't want to kind of second guess a director, but it does seem as though Sorrentino is an aggressively stylish film, to the point where what you're seeing on screen is so some of it is so gross,
and
excessive, but you can't help but kind of admire it, and not just the filmmaking, but admire the like the physicality of what is happening on the screen. And it's just all very hedonistic. It's all so easy to watch. Like, you know, parties are fun to watch. You know, and but there's a point in this film where it's a 2.5 hour long film where the parties are not fun to watch anymore. Like, they're starting to get ugly.
It
and
like
disturbing.
Delves down into the depths of hell.
And you realize that for the first portion of the film, you were kind of culpable in that kind of the idea that parties are kind of virtuous and fun and exciting.
Yeah, it goes from this kind of seduction. In the end, it's just like a really bad date that won't end.
Yeah, no, it's very true. It's very true. And you feel terrible by the end of the film for kind of, for allowing yourself to get caught up in it.
So what were the standout scenes for you guys? What were the moments that have really stayed in your mind? Because for a 2.5 hour film, you know, you can't, they're not all winners. But what are the ones that have really kept you up?
So for me, it was definitely the scene where Berlusconi sort of goes back to his roots and tries to sell a poor old lady an apartment that isn't even built yet.
That's a great scene.
Yeah, that's a really good scene.
He's just on the phone, right?
Yeah, on the phone. And you kind of have a glimpse into this man who has created this persona. You know, he's super charismatic and he's got the gift of the gab, and it's all sleight of hand. You know, he like it's misdirection, and he's selling a dream, which he, you know, sort of goes off of in his political career as well. You know, he sort of makes all these grandiose promises that he later can't keep. But it's when he's trying to go back to that, you know, and find his way back to, you know, his heyday. Mm. That was a really good scene for me.
It's a really key scene, I think, as well, because it contains so many. It kind of opens up this idea that this character, the reason he's so deplorable is because he knows exactly what he's doing. Like, he is completely kind of amoral. And he says, I think a really key line in the film is when he says, the truth is men are limited beings. They are slaves to infantile temptations. They do not see the future, which they later regret. Like, if he knows that, then why has he made such a mess of Italy? Like, you know, he's so aware of it, yet he doesn't care about his selfishness, because to him it feels so inherent. And, you know, the sad thing is he's right about a lot of those things that he says. And it's the fact that he is aware of it doesn't necessarily excuse him from it.
Yeah.
It's not a particularly great scene, guys, but can we talk about the sheep?
The sheep.
I mean, Kelly, you mentioned this. Yeah. I mean, what?
I don't know. It confused me. I forgot that it happened.
It's the opening of the film.
Yeah, it's the opening, and I totally forgot about it until I was thinking about, and I was like, "Whoa, that happened."
So for context, opening scene of the film: a sheep walks into Berlusconi's Sardinia mansion and gets killed by the aircon.
That is a strange scene, and for me, this is where the film. Because I've heard people discuss that scene as well online, and there's a lot of talk about how the sheep kind of represents Italy, kind of like lambs being led to the slaughter, but like slowly.
But
like
enticed not, by this mansion. Of,
yeah,
you know.
Like slowly being led and dying of the cold. Right?
Well, it's not a bad metaphor. Hey.
But for me, that's like where I think Laura has quite a clear thesis, which is which is kind of summed up in the line that I mentioned that Berlusconi says. And and I think that one of the problems with the film is that, like, it revels in that thesis a little bit too much. Like, once we know it, once we get it, we kind of just have to let ourselves in, go, like, into the kind of party scene and just enjoy it. And that can be a bit frustrating. But, you know, it's a good job that the movie is extremely... I mean, the ecstasy, the pills flying down from the sky that at the party, that scene is kind of like... it typifies Sorrentino, and it's a lot of fun. It goes on for ages, too.
Yeah,
it's
it does.
A lot of fun.
Yeah.
Which is cool.
Very, like, well, what we think of now is like Adam McKay-ish scene where you've got a non-character coming in to explain stuff to the audience.
Yeah, no, I agree.
And this kind of over-edited sequence. And
No, it's a really good component.
Yeah, there does definitely seem to be that kind of movement at the moment, these big, powerful figures. We're going to show the opulence and the degradation of society through this ostentatious wealth.
Yeah.
You know, like you say, actually, that link, I didn't really think about that before, but the link between, say, this and Vice.
Mm.
You know, it's clearly like, these are the people that are causing all our problems now. These are the people that have slowly got more powerful. You know, whether you want to look at a Trump-type figure or a Berlusconi-type figure, it's definitely one of the hot sort of cinematic sort of tropes, I think, at the moment.
Yeah, but for some reason, I think, for me, Loro did work a lot better than Vice.
Okay.
Because I think that it doesn't really have a political stance, I want to say. I mean, it's obviously kind of critical of Berlusconi. It's not by any means saying like, oh, I'll give him a chance. But I think it's far more interested in a man in that kind of position of power
than it is, you know. Wrap this up by talking about Berlusconi and his wife, Veronica Lero, played by Elena Sofia Ricci, which I think is the sort of the core of the film, really. You have all these stuff we've been talking about, these really opulent parties and the drug scenes and the sex scenes. But I think ultimately these are the scenes that have stayed with me, the scenes between this couple. What did you think about those?
I mean, I likened it very much to the fight between Carmela and Tony Soprano at the end of season 4 of The Sopranos.
Yeah.
It's the same themes. It's the idea that there's a man there who is kind of like, he sleeps around, he has a lot of power that he abuses, he's violent, I guess Berlusconi isn't violent, but he's kind of aggressive in a lot of his kind of pursuits.
He's aggressive in that fight.
Yeah. But at the same time, you've got this woman who has, like, benefited from all of that.
Mm.
Yeah.
Who is, like, there criticising and yelling at him.
Oh, she's complicit.
Like, yeah,
there's
no doubt.
That's his comeback every time well, why do you stay
with
him?
You've gained from this. Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
and he's right, in a way. Like, and that's what makes it such a complex, interesting scene. But it does seem lifted straight from The Sopranos.
Yeah, I mean the one thing I would completely agree. The one thing I would say is that whereas The Sopranos, you quite want to go back to these characters, and you can rewatch The Sopranos. That's, you know, anything between Tony and Carmela. You can watch those many times. Whereas Loro is an interesting film, but I'm not necessarily sure that it will stand up to repeated viewings.
Mm. Yeah, yeah. I think it's like the party that, like you said earlier, it's the party you want to forget.
Yeah, for sure. You just want to go home and get into bed.
Yeah.
And on that note then, while we give Loro the all go, do we think then Dragged Across Concrete was a drag or congrete?
Wow, you're really stretching there,
that was
man.
That was a reach.
Should we tell people
what it
was?
Kelly, what is, after that abrupt transition?
Yeah, exactly.
Nice.
Can you want to tell us, what is Dragged Across Concrete? What is it about?
Who's right, it for? So this is a sort of old school feeling, hard-boiled crime drama.
Yes.
That follows two old school cops, played by Mel Gibson and Vince Vaughn, who are suspended without pay after using excessive force on a suspect. So out of job and out of money, they decide to plan a robbery of a wealthy criminal, but their heist quickly turns complicated and things go further south for the pair.
Okay, so this is S. Craig Zahler's third film. So after Bone Tomahawk and Brawling Cell Block 99, I'm a huge fan of both those films. Where do we stand on Zahler's work up to here?
Love a bit of Zahler. Gotta be said, I think he's doing stuff with genre that you could argue is, if not the best in American cinema, it's certainly near the top.
Right.
With Bone Tomahawk, he obviously smashed together a Western and a horror film, and really, it's one of those films you can't forget, Bone Tomahawk.
Yeah.
And Brawl in Cellblock 99 again is a reinvigoration of the prison drama. And then this, well, this is something else entirely. This is like a stretched out funky heist film that's, you know, nearly 3 hours long, takes its time, but it's got so much going on. But it, even aside from the great dialogue and whatever, and we can talk about it being post Tarantino, which a lot of people will, that'll be the obvious thing, but for me it's more like a throwback to like some of the great kind of French crime films, you know, from the sort of 60s or whatever, in that it's really beautiful and it kind of, you think about it a lot afterwards as well, you know.
Yeah, it's a really exciting film. Yeah, Zala's a really interesting filmmaker who carries on kind of doing whatever he wants. And I think everyone in the kind of film world at the moment's definitely got their eye on him, thinking like, who is this guy and what are his intentions?
Yeah.
And how did he get so much money and so much freedom?
Where has he come from? Like, from a, he was a musician.
Yeah,
I think,
done all sorts. He's written novels and he's written scripts and he feels like a guy who's just like, oh, I'll take that on, I'll take that on, I'll take that on. And like, he's like a lot of filmmakers who are trusted by any financiers or whatever. Even stuff like Bone Tomahawk, he's shot in something ridiculous like 21 days or something. And when you see it, it's like an extremely accomplished film.
It's such
for a first film.
This is the thing
about
him, right?
And then each time it's like he's getting more and more ambitious and he'll do more and more. It's like, who knows what he'll get up to next?
Yeah.
You know?
Well, he's getting ambitious as a filmmaker, but he's also getting very cocky in his kind of aggressively apolitical stance of like, my films aren't political films. My films are like about violence. My films are about like humanity and like pathos and things like that. And you mentioned Tarantino, and like, you compare Zala to Tarantino, and I'm not sure if it's the climate, the social climate, or the filmmaking itself, but there's certainly a lot more kind of cultural, political undertones going on in Zala's work than I ever noticed in Tarantino's.
Yeah, well, I think, because Tarantino's characters, they're all pop culture aware, aren't they? They're fun and the dialogue's poppy. Here, the dialogue is a bit more sort of muted and internalised and purely character-based rather than anything external. Yeah. But then with that comes an underlying, like you say, sort of... Well, there's a thing people have picked up on in these three films, that they are perhaps veer to the right. And Zala said in every single interview, like, you're right, Stephen, he's, you know, consistently said in countless interviews, no, I'm not a political filmmaker, I'm not a political filmmaker. Yeah. And let's talk about hiring Mel Gibson, because that's the one that's kind of pushed this one over the edge. That's when we were like, okay, there's something going on here.
When was the last time you saw Mel Gibson in a film? Like,
He was in a really good, actually, there's a revenge film that he did a couple of years ago that was quite sort of tough, that was called
Edge of...
No, but it's called Blood Sun or something of that ilk. That might, I might have the title wrong, and I really should have Googled this stuff before I come on. What a professional, right? But like, the truth of the matter is that it was only like, it didn't really do a lot. It didn't really do a lot in terms of money, but it was like a well-made... Gibson looks terrible in it, you know.
Yeah.
Bloodfather, it might have been. God,
I think it is Bloodfather.
Yeah, that's it. Bloodfather, not Bloods. But it's
shot
good.
Somewhere in Bulgaria. Yeah.
But it's really like, you know, a tough kind of, you know, revengey westerny kind of vibe to it. You know, without being an actual western. The thing is with Mel, like, you know, we all love, or well, not all, but generally speaking, Lethal Weapon. You want to watch that. You want to watch that repeatedly. Mad Max. You want to watch that repeatedly. And then, of course, he ruins it all by getting drunk and that awful anti-Semitic stuff that we all know him for as well. And that, yeah, you know, there's the age-old thing about separating the art from the artist. And I feel like it's a conversation we're collectively in the film world, we're having more and more and more, you know, when stuff keeps coming out, obviously it's the Weinstein stuff and whatever, and the climate now is every week we feel like there's a new actor and a new director, something bad is going to come out about. Yeah. You know, we're all sort of hoping, and I hope it's not my hero next week because it's really bad, you know?
But the thing is, I agree with separating the artist from the artist, but Zala doesn't do that here. That's the thing. Like, you can't do that if you're going to have a scene in which Mel Gibson, like, talks about how the media is ruining people's lives.
Right,
like,
exactly.
I actually think Mel Gibson's really great in this film.
Yeah.
I think he's a great piece of casting.
He's a really good actor, isn't he?
He's a great actor. Yeah. And like, Zala, as much as I hate to say it, because it does seem like a kind of element of like, I'm going to troll you by putting Mel Gibson in my film.
And you're going to like it. Yeah.
It's actually not. Like, he's so good in this, and his presence on the screen is so like welcomed in a creepy way. But yeah, and then he goes and inserts kind of like scenes which brush up against racism, scenes which brush up against kind of like political correctness or anti-political correctness. And yeah, this is a very violent kind of movie.
Oh, it's savage, isn't
it? Yeah,
it's savage is
a great
word
to use, yeah. And it's for a film that, again, is 2.5 hours long.
Yeah, another long one.
Unlike Laura, this is very like narratively driven.
Good. They're so well paced, this movie, I found. Yeah. I really like. Remember when we, Sam, Stephen, and I saw it at LFF together, and it was a day where I'd seen, I think, five. That was my fifth film of the day. Yeah,
I had to convince you, didn't I?
I was like, oh, I don't know if I could do this. Yeah. Anyway, I went. I'm glad I did because there was a Q&A with Zala afterwards.
Yeah.
But the fifth film of the day, almost three hour long. It didn't feel like it at all for me. I was totally engaged with the whole movie all the way through.
I'm engaged with him as a filmmaker. Yeah. Full stop. Yeah. Like, yeah. I don't necessarily think, wow, this guy's doing everything I love.
Because it makes
me feel uncomfortable as a filmmaker. I'm sure he'd be really happy to hear that.
Yeah.
But not uncomfortable. Like, I can't figure him out, and I can't sit here and say like this is what S. Craig Zahler wants. I'm certainly engaged with him as an artist.
Yeah, I mean, whatever else people say about Zahler's work, there's no, you don't ever feel like, oh, this is a cookie cutter. Oh, look, we've seen this 50,000 times before. Even though he's generally working within the parameters of genre filmmaking, it's like you feel like there's always going to be a surprise in the next couple of minutes, within the scene you're doing. You know, like the scene where, is it Vince Vaughn eats a sandwich?
Yeah.
So this scene goes on for ages. And we've got an interview with S. Craig Zahler on the Curzon blog at the moment, if you want to check that out. And he says about this scene with the sandwich, and I convert it to the scene in Brawl in Cellblock 99 where Vince Vaughn dismantles the car.
That's a great scene as well.
That just goes on forever, and you're like, this scene doesn't have any reason to be in this film. It doesn't advance the plot at all. It didn't do anything. And Zahler said, these are the favourite scenes I like to write about. People know me for my violence, but I like these scenes where characters do things that immediately you know so much more about that character from such a small action that takes so long. And the sandwich scene is like, okay, these guys have done this before.
Yeah.
This is the 50th time these guys have done this kind of thing together.
Yeah.
And immediately, okay, that's their rapport.
But that's what's interesting about Zahler is I heard him say like, oh, you know, you learn so much about Vince Vaughn's character in Brawl in Cellblock 99 because instead of like beating up his girlfriend, he beats up her car. Yeah. And I'm like, that's still a terrible thing to do. and a shocking thing to do. Yeah. Like, that's not okay. Just because you're angry doesn't mean you could destroy someone's property. I don't know. Like,
yeah.
But then, I don't know. He seems to, I think Zahler seems to make a lot of excuses for his character.
Oh,
true,
yeah.
True.
But you're right that he also has this masterful kind of hold over them in individual scenes where he will make them eat a sandwich and it will be so engrossing.
But I love that, like, when filmmakers do this thing where, oh, we'll shoot a scene, but we'll take it much, much further than the natural or what is ordinary or whatever. The two immediate examples that, okay, completely different filmmakers, but like one would be the Stanley Kubrick thing in Clockwork Orange where you just got the droogs and they're in the car and the shot is held forever and you're like, wow, this is insane.
Yeah.
And no other filmmaker at the time would go, oh yeah, I'll do that. That's just something crazy to do. And then you've got someone like Steve McQueen in, I think it's Hunger, where they're just washing the corridor. I don't know if you guys have seen it, but they're washing the corridor and it's literally someone washing a dirty, slopped out prison corridor for like 5 minutes walking down the end. And it's, in the end, the meaning of it changes over the time. It's not just a couple of seconds. You're really like, oh my God, this is terrible. This is absolutely terrible. So, I mean, I'm not saying Zahler's necessarily been influenced by those guys, but actually, no, it's just an interesting cinematic trick.
I think Kubrick's a fairly apt comparison, to be honest. Like, I know a lot of filmmakers get compared to Kubrick and it's kind of a lazy comparison, but there's definitely an element of it there, I think.
So, let's talk then about what we want to see from Zahler next. So he's doing what he wants. With these three films are evidence of that, and they're evidence that he can do what he wants. Like the scenes we've just been talking about, most studios would say you absolutely cannot have this scene in the film. You cannot have 10 minutes screen time devoted to characters eating a sandwich and then have that level of violence as well. With,
I don't know who is backing this guy's movie. We had this conversation after the screen, like, who is giving this guy the room to work like this?
But it's there. But what do you want to see him do next? Do you want him to stick with this kind of genre stuff? Do you want to see him move in a completely different direction? Where do you want to see his career go?
Like I say, for me, I want to see him do a period costume drama, right? Because obviously, like, he's a huge fan of just completely spinning the minds of the audience, right? He loves messing with people, with the viewers, without a doubt. And of course, the people who are the Zala fans, like us lot, like a load of people out there, are like, yeah, do it, Craig, do it. We want to see some more. We want to see some more. Like,
take
how can
further.
You? Yeah, do it. So, like, really, the biggest, the craziest thing he could do would be completely go in a different direction. Like I say, ever go at a costume drama or ever go at a musical or just do something completely wild. I mean, he probably won't, but that would be amazing to see. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I think I can see him probably after his most recent film that he's writing is the Puppet Master film.
Which comes out this week as well.
I can see him kind of delving back into horror personally, which I think he keeps brushing up on in all of his films.
Yeah. There's some horror elements.
Yeah, sure. I think I can see him kind of, because he hasn't made a pure horror film yet.
No.
I'd love to see him ever go at a slasher though, right?
I'd be great. Two and a half hour like character-driven slasher movie. I'm glad we've got a filmmaker like this, but I'm seeing a lot of people kind of shut down conversations about his political correctness. I don't think we should be shutting those conversations down. No. We should be having them, and I think Zala would probably say the same thing. Like, that's probably what he's trying to do with his film. So whatever he does next, I think it's probably going to be controversial.
And that is it for this week. So Loro is in cinemas and on Curzon Home Cinema, along with the Paolo Sorrentino collection. So we've got Il Divo, The Great Beauty, This Must Be the Place, and The Consequences of Love. We've also got Still Country, starring Andrew Scott, he of Sherlock and Fleabag fame. Those are in cinemas and on demand as well. And Dragged Across Concrete is out in cinemas today. Lou, thank you very much for being on with us.
It's been a pleasure.
Stephen, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
Kelly?
Thanks.
Thank you very much for listening. If you have any thoughts on Laura or Dragged Across Concrete, you do email podcast@curzon.com for next week's show, or you can tweet us at Curzon Cinemas. If you like the show, you can subscribe, leave a review, or comment on iTunes, Acast, or wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you very much. See you next week.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.